From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. A gospel musician once forgotten is remembered again.
There are so many mysteries, and if you go to the biblical connotation of it, many mysteries we will never uncover about him.
That's Doris Neely of Teague, Texas. She's talking about musician Washington Phillips. His music has been revived by the Georgia record label Dust to Digital. We'll take a listen this hour. First, though, last week we talked with film director John Waters.
If you want to change somebody's mind, you get them to laugh. And it's going to be tough at Christmas when everybody goes home because of politics this year. There's going to be a lot of trees knocked over. So I'm telling everybody to bring a political abuse whistle. And every time somebody starts talking about politics, just blow it. And people start laughing, and then they won't get on each other's nerves or knock over the tree in a fist fight.
So here are your first thoughts. Stephen Sheehan tweets to us, "A friend and I saw Pink Flamingos completely by accident and without warning. It came on after the film we'd gone to see. I've been a fan of Mr. Waters' work since." Yesterday, we got a commentary from former state representative Stacey Evans about sexual harassment in government.
"Just last week in Alabama, you saw the power of women. They came out in force to shut down Roy Moore. But in so doing, they sent a message to all politicians whose first duty is to themselves, it seems, and not the people they serve."
Cass Mutta tweets, "Stacey Evans is conveniently rewriting history by claiming women defeated Moore in Alabama. White women voted in majority for Moore. KH replied to that, rewriting history to erase contributions of black women, and so it continues." And Jason G. added, "We all know it was the black vote which kept Moore out. Why do we consistently fall short of giving credit where credit is due concerning the power of the black and Latino vote?" And according to CNN exit polls, 98% of black women voted for Democrat Doug Jones in the Alabama Senate race. 63% of white women voted for Republican candidate Roy Moore. It is always good to get your thoughts on what we talk about. So call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk or post to Facebook. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. The Georgia Department of Community Health changed a law in 2012. They reduced subsidies for retirees who were in the school system fewer than 5 years. And that means fewer benefits than they'd hoped for, and in some cases were told they would get. Former Georgia educators have now filed a class action lawsuit against the state. And with me to explain is James Salzer, reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
First, can we talk about what the law provided before it was changed?
Yeah, it was a policy change that the Department of Community Health Board made right at the end of 2011. And essentially, the teachers involved in this are arguing that before that policy change, once they retired, kind of no matter how many years they had in, once they had vested into the system, which is, I think, 10 years, that they would get the same health benefits as they got as teachers, retiree health benefits. Retired teachers now get health, you know, they're part of the state health benefit plan, so they get health benefits.
Right. So they changed this. And why did the department change it? Was it simply cost cutting?
Well, the department would not talk to me on the give me an interview, but they did answer some questions. And from those, it appears that they were doing it to save money for the state health benefit plan. That plan covers something like 650,000 Georgians, so
yeah.
it's a big plan, and pretty regularly they put out reports saying 2, 3, 4 years down the line, if we don't do anything, it's gonna, you know, be in the red. And so, but they did not. I asked them how much it was gonna save, and they didn't answer that question. So I'm not sure if they have an estimate or not.
And it's going to probably be harder to get those questions answered now that there's an actual lawsuit.
I would assume so.
Let's hear from one group unhappy with these changes. It's Teachers Rally Against Georgia Insurance Changes. Tragic. Here's spokesman John Palmer saying it's the way it was implemented that has caused the most concern.
If you want to talk policy, if the DCA wants to change this policy, wants to have a conversation about it, that's fine. But to go back and retroactively apply this policy to folks who have been working for 10 years with the promise of a certain set of benefits, I think that's wrong. and I don't think it's legal.
What does the class action lawsuit claim? What's their basis for the suit?
It's essentially that that they were promised this once they took the job as a teacher, that they were promised certain benefits. In terms of, for instance, pensions, which they also get after 10 years, and it goes up as the number of years they serve, the number of years. In court, that's been shown essentially to be a rule to be a contract. And from reading the lawsuit, that looks kind of like the argument they're making is that they were promised this so they that you can't go back and say retroactively, you weren't here enough years when
right.
we changed the policy.
It's like they're claiming breach of contract.
Right, exactly.
That they had made a contractual obligation. That's why people stayed 10 years in some cases, and now they're changing.
Right, and that's the reason this is all coming up now is that the policy essentially if you were hired in 2007, the school year 2007, your contract starts in the middle of the year for that school year. 10 years forward is this year.
Yeah.
So if you retired this year, you know,
you're
that's
out of luck. Okay, so here's John Palmer again. Again, he is with Tragic, the teachers group. And he says almost none of the people affected were actually notified properly.
The first notice anybody got they were affected by it went out, I think it was December 23rd of 2016, before it went into effect on January 1st, 2017. They sent a notice to HR departments when it first passed in 2011. They sent it in December when most were already on break. They did not at that point tell anyone to inform employees that the policy had changed.
How common is that complaint, to the best of your knowledge, that people didn't know this was happening?
That's a very common complaint. But the one of the things is I think, and I may be wrong about this, but I'm pretty sure that the notice that they sent to employees in December went to employees that were hired after the date this went into effect. So the people who really were affected by it, who were in that cohort from got hired between 2007 and 2012. I don't think that they got the
notice.
I don't think it was sent to them. I might be wrong, but I don't think it was.
Which means they were affected by the law but weren't, as far as you know, even notified that the change was occurring, and they didn't find out until they were trying to retire?
Right. What a number of people that I talked to who are affected by this said was, you know, when you retire, you talk to someone in HR, someone in your system. And they say, you know, these are the benefits, this is what you're going to get. And a number of them said that they talked to their local people in, like, March before they retired June 1st and still were not told about it. So they found out when the new fiscal year started and the new rates went up to 300%.
So, and again, you haven't been able to get an interview with the state or with the Georgia Department of Community Health, and that's probably less likely now that a lawsuit has been filed. But does this only affect retirees from the schools, or does it affect everyone who gets state benefits?
I think it affects everyone who gets state benefits. That's a good question, because I know I've focused on, in my reporting, on the schools, but I'm
because
assuming
they're
it
the
affects
ones suing.
Everyone's in state health benefit plan, so I'm assuming that it also affects state employees that were in that period.
Which, in interest of full disclosure, not only includes a vast number of people, but also includes employees at Georgia Public Broadcasting.
Sure.
So what happens now? They filed a class action lawsuit, and the next step is for actually the court proceedings to begin?
Yeah, I assume in these kind of cases, the state will respond. So they'll file a response, and, you know, then it goes through the proceedings. But, you know, these cases generally take a long,
yeah,
long time. One of the questions some of these former employees have is, what's the legislature going to do about it? Because the legislature could act. I haven't talked to any legislator who said they're going to, but they have been contacting legislators because when Tragic began, Tragic essentially began because of changes in the state health benefit plan three or four years ago. Within a month, the legislature put more money in the budget to kind of pull back some of the changes that were made so that...
So they responded.
Yes. So there is a possibility. That
and again, TRAGIC stands for Teachers Rally Against Georgia Insurance Changes. But it sounds like even before this lawsuit was filed and for the years before, the state was already saying, or at least the Department of Community Health was saying, something needs to be done because we're not going to have enough money to
right.
cover everyone in the system.
Right. Right. And I think, you know, there's kind of a distinction on this is in that, you know, the people I'm talking to are the people who were affected this year or are going to be affected moving forward. But I don't think they're saying that no change should have taken place. I think they're saying it shouldn't have affected people who were promised the benefits once they were in the job. So the state employees pension system was changed about a decade ago for similar reasons because they thought it was not affordable, and so they changed it for new hires or people going forward. They didn't go back.
They didn't go retroactively.
Say, oh, you've only been here 4 years. We're going to change your pension.
Right. Okay, so in any case, the lawsuit is seeking redress for people who were hired under one set of circumstances and those
right.
circumstances changed.
Essentially, they're asking that the people that were hired before the policy took effect, which was January 1st, 2012, be treated the same as every other employee, treated in the way the system worked until that point rather than having it change.
Meaning that if you are hired after January of 2012, the lawsuit won't protect you.
I mean, that's the way I read it. Yeah.
Unless. Because we're getting ready to have a legislative session.
Yes. Yay.
Unless some legislator steps
forward. Yeah. I mean, like I said, they've been contacting legislators and.
And that's where you usually work is up at the Capitol.
Yeah.
But there's no scuttlebutt at this point about any legislation.
No, I don't know that they've gotten, any response from anyone who said, that may be the reason the lawsuit was filed because they weren't getting a response from legislators. But
Yeah, but the lawsuit will probably take years.
The lawsuit will definitely take years.
Yes, and the legislative redress would certainly take months.
Yes.
So this isn't going to be solved anytime soon.
Unless the legislature does something right.
But really quickly, come on.
Yeah. You never know.
I remain skeptical. I've been covering politicians for too long. James Seltzer is a reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. James, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And it sounds like we're going to have you back at some point because,
Legislature's here.
Legislature is coming. I know. The Gold Dome continues. Happy holidays and thank you.
You too.
Coming up, a mysterious instrument, a case of mistaken identity, and a disappearing act will solve a musical mystery. First, though, how Coca-Cola made those cute Christmas polar bears and why. This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Who hasn't heard this jingle around this time of year? That's Coca-Cola's signature tune. And every year, the Atlanta-based company releases a slew of holiday ads that are almost as traditional as eggnog. The Coke ads of the 1930s are largely credited with inventing our modern conception of Santa Claus. And in the 1990s, Coke introduced their iconic polar bears in their TV ads. We talked last year about the history of Coca-Cola's Christmas marketing with author Mark Pendergrast. He's a leading expert on Coke and wrote the book For God, Country, and Coca-Cola.
Good to be here.
So What do we know about how these ads began, the original ads going back to the 1930s?
Well, in 1931, Coca-Cola hired an artist named Haddon Sundblom to create a Santa Claus ad. Now, you have to remember, in those days, Coke primarily relied on magazine advertising, and they would hire really fine artists such as N.C. Wyeth or Norman Rockwell to create heartwarming ads. And Sundblom at first used a retired Coca-Cola man as his model, but when he died, he used himself.
For Santa.
Yeah. Yeah. For Santa. And he created what really is the modern image of Santa Claus. Until then, Santa was sort of tall and gaunt in European tradition. He often wore not just red, but green or yellow or blue. And so Sundblom created a large, jolly, Coca-Cola red-clad Santa in ads where he was rewarded for his delivery of presents by having a Coke and cookies. And so when I was a kid, we had a little stuffed Santa Claus when I grew up in Atlanta with a little tiny Coca-Cola.
We actually had the exact same stuffed Santa Claus in our house as well with the tiny bottle of Coke, and that's in Los Angeles. So it's not just Georgia.
Yeah. But what's interesting is the origin, the real purpose behind this ad was to attract, you know, kids as Coca-Cola consumers. And the real background goes back to the year 1912 when Coca-Cola was sued by the federal government in a suit that could have put them out of business. And one of the accusations was that Coke was trying to appeal to children with this drink that had an addictive drug, caffeine, in it. And ever since then, Coke has avoided, at least in the United States, showing children under 12 consuming their product. But that didn't mean that they didn't try to appeal to them through school programs, or they would, you know, have kids go for a tour of the local Coca-Cola bottling plant and give them rulers that said Coca-Cola on them and things like that. So the Santa ad was certainly intended for kids, because Coke knew that if you can instill wonderful good memories and the taste of Coca-Cola at a young age, they would become lifelong consumers.
So it has become so ingrained, at least in American society, that this year when Coke released their ad, there was a fairly large outcry. People complained that Santa Claus didn't wink at the kid at the end of the advertisement, and that the Santa never handed the young man a Coke. I mean, people are wrapped up. One person said, they ruined my Christmas.
Well, the funny thing is, this wasn't in America. This was in the UK. This was in England. So for the last 21 years in England, they have a Coca-Cola truck with Santa Claus on the side and on the back of the truck, brightly lit, that goes throughout the country. And it's become embedded in England, as this is the way that Christmas starts, somewhere around the beginning of December. And there was a huge outcry that their TV adverts, as they put it, didn't have Santa coming to life and winking and handing a Coke to a kid. Apparently, they don't have the it's not forbidden to show children drinking Coke in England.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, apparently he's never winked. This is kind of an example of how an urban myth can begin. He did come to life, however. You know, he would be animated, and he would hand a Coke to a kid. And they're having a complete fit over there.
But never in any Coke ad did Santa wink at anybody. Is that what you're saying?
I don't think so. I haven't been able to find one, and the company says he didn't. But it's a good idea. They should have him wink now.
I'm speaking with author Mark Pendergrast. His book is called For God, Country, and Coca-Cola. And as we head into the holiday season, we're examining the history of how Coca-Cola kind of invented our image of Santa Claus. Now, they changed over to polar bears for the most part in the 1990s. Why?
Well, the polar bears are not necessarily Christian, so that might have had something to do with it. Maybe they were trying to be more diverse. It was sort of an accident that the polar bears happened in the first place. There was kind of a shootout between McCann Erickson, the traditional Coke advertiser, and Creative Artists Alliance, CAA, which was Mike Ovitz from Hollywood. And he was saying, oh, we can do much better ads with Hollywood directors like Francis Ford Coppola. Well, their ads weren't that good, but they did create this first polar bear computer simulation of these, you know, polar bears watching the northern lights and sighing with contentment as they drank Coke. And then they realized, hey, we can, you know, we can show mama polar bear giving a Coke to baby polar bear as a reward.
Oh, and they bypassed the rule on not giving it to kids because it's a
exactly.
cub.
Yes, exactly.
Very clever.
And then, you know, later on when polar bear habitat was clearly in danger because of global warming, they gave money beginning in 2011 to the World Wildlife Fund to try to protect polar bear habitat. So it kind of matched their advertising.
Their branding. Let's listen to a bit of a commercial from 2012 featuring Coke's famous polar bears. So it's hard to, you have to kind of imagine what's going on since polar bears don't actually talk. But let's compare that with an ad from 1995. This was when, this was called Santa Pack.
New Coca-Cola Santa Packs, the only real holiday refreshment. Look for this display at your store.
Holiday refreshments like we bring. Unwrap a Santa Pack, it's always a real thing.
I mean, they're chanting Santa Pack there, so still all in on Santa as of 1995. But why Christmas season in particular for Coke? I mean, when I think of an evening, Christmas Eve or something, I'm thinking about drinking apple cider and eggnog. I'm not thinking about drinking a Coke.
Well, it all goes back to kids again. I mean, what is the best time of year for children? It's Christmas when you get all these wonderful presents, and why not attach it to Santa? So when you leave something for Santa, you know, it's not just milk and cookies, it's Coke and cookies. So it's and Coca-Cola really is best when it's ice cold. So, you know,
oh, not in Europe. Bears, they drink it without ice.
Well, they're insane. I once was on a German program. You know, I have the original formula of Coca-Cola in my book. It was a big deal. And so they flew me over to Germany, and they gave me this lukewarm Coke that they had made from my formula. And they said, did it taste like Coke? I said, yeah, it tastes sort of like flat, awful lukewarm Coke.
Right. All right.
But,
well,
it really deserves to be ice cold. But, you know, I don't think that they've backed away from Santa. You know, I think that the some of the best Coca-Cola advertising, and it's because I'm a baby boomer, but I like the sort of heartland, heartwarming ads.
Yeah.
When they start doing rap music, it leaves me cold. So I love the Santa and the polar bears.
That's author Mark Pendergrast. He's author of the book For God, Country, and Coca-Cola. Georgia band Algiers released their sophomore record, The Underside of Power, this summer. NPR Music describes it as one of the year's most ambitious and intense records. GPB's Sean Powers caught up with the lead singer in October.
My name is Franklin James Fisher. I'm the singer in Algiers.
Broken shards of every hour and sometime.
Algiers emerged out of just what was the three of us, Ryan, Lee, and myself, just needing a way to engage the wider absurdity that was the world and geopolitical incident. What we wanted to do on this record was just to elaborate on musical and thematic ideas. And I think with The Underside of Power, the song itself, it was a very good representation of that. The only meaning is just talking about the idea that ultimately the people who are in power will lose power one way or another. Want to subscribe to a sort of optimism. We're not the most ostensibly optimistic band in the world, but even if civilization collapses with you, that's still somewhat of an optimistic view, I think. This record was actually very much like a jigsaw puzzle. We wanted to record it in a relatively short period of time, and that got way out of our hands, way out of our control, and so it turned into a very long and tedious process from working in a studio for the first 2 or 3 weeks of the first session to working in at least 5 or 6 different studios in 3 different countries with 7 different engineers and a handful of different producers. And you realize at a certain point that to what extent your control over what it is that you want to create is limited. But we are very proud of it, and we think that that sort of organized chaos perfectly reflects where we were as a band at the time of its recording. And maybe it reflects the sort of electricity in the air of what was happening politically as well. The song Walk Like a Panther was influenced by a couple of things. Fred Hampton, very charismatic leader of the Black Panther Party in Chicago, and he was murdered by the police and the FBI. And that's that sample that you hear that starts the record, that starts the song. Fred Hampton, he was an incredible, and I think it really, the intent here was to kind of let people know exactly where we stand coming out of the gate, and to kind of reclaim history, in a sense, because history has been revised to such a great extent, particularly in public schools and in the public consciousness with regards to who the Black Panthers were and what they were fighting for. I've heard things as obscene and absurd as saying that they were the black equivalent of the Ku Klux Klan, which is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. From my point of view, lyrically, the song Walk Like a Panther had to do with the sort of cultural appropriation of black music and the so-called artists that willingly play into that appropriation for their own gain, without regards as to what that entails or what the fallout is for their communities or for their culture and the people that they sell out for their own material gain or their own status. And that, to me, is a form of, you know, probably the highest form of treason culturally that you could create. And that came from just experiences and things that I've seen. And so lyrically, that's what I'm talking about. If you decide to be in a band, it's something that chooses you. You know, it's like a labor of love almost. If we make a connection, you know, with people, we make friends and other creative people who are trying to do things that of real impact in communities and society, then that's, you can't really ask for any more than that.
That's Franklin James Fisher. He's the lead singer of the Atlanta-based group Algiers. Just ahead, for years, mystery surrounded musician Washington Phillips. Now, thanks to an Atlanta-based record label, his story can be told. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. For decades, mystery surrounded gospel musician Washington Phillips. He played mostly in his hometown of Teague, Texas, on his own unique instrument, his manzarine. Phillips only recorded 18 tracks in the late 1920s and literally has not been heard from since much. But an Atlanta-based record label, Dust to Digital, has changed that. It's remastered and repackaged that music into a collection called Washington Phillips and His Manzarine Dreams. The album is up for a Grammy Award, and here's one of those tracks, Lift Him Up, That's All.
When Jesus was around here on this land, he said he did do his father's command. Because he knew that he was his father's only son, he came to draw men unto him.
Dust to Digital co-founder Lance Ledbetter joins me now. Hi there, Lance.
Hi, Celeste.
Also with us is Michael Corcoran, a music journalist based in Austin. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Celeste.
And on the phone from Teague, Texas is Doris Neely. Doris was a friend of Washington Phillips before he passed away. Hi, Doris.
Hi, I was a neighbor.
A neighbor of his. Which side did you live on?
Which side? Simsbury community, where he lived.
Uh-huh. How long did you know him?
From a child up until he died in 1954.
So before we start talking about how important he was, Doris, maybe you could tell us a little bit about what kind of guy he was. What kind of neighbor was he?
He was a good neighbor, but as a child he was scary because he was different. But the music brought us all together. He would perform at community functions such as 19th of June and special occasions when they would allow him to perform. At other times, he would just play the music up and down the back roads of Simsbury community. And then he would come on into Teague, which is about 7 miles away, and with his donkeys and his wagon and his music. And he would play the music to let people know that he was coming. It sort of reminded me of the current ice cream trucks that go up and down the streets in Teague selling their goods.
What was he? What instrument was he playing on when you saw him performing?
As a child and as I grew up, I really can't say because it really didn't matter to me. All we knew was he was playing something that was flat and in that. And had to lay on a flat surface, but he would lay it down in this little wagon. The donkeys would be in front, and he would lay this instrument down in back. And as a child, I never paid any attention to its form or what it was, but it was just beautiful music. It was the kind of music that struck your attention.
Michael, it's important what instrument he was playing, right? There are people to this day who insist he played on those recordings a dulciola. Why is that not correct?
Well, they based that information on something that was said offhandedly in the studio and written down in the notes. There was really no proof of it at all. And it was pretty much accepted as fact until I started doing my research, and I started talking to the people from Simsboro and from Teague, and I asked them to show me what it looked like when he was playing, and they were strumming strings, and a dulciola is a keyboard instrument.
And you showed some of them a picture of a dulciola, and they said, that's not it, right?
Yeah, they said, that's not it. And then I showed them the picture that was found in an ad in, I think, 1928 in Louisiana Weekly. And it showed him holding these two zithers that were sort of Frankenstein together. And they were going, yeah, that's it. But they kept saying
it was in a box. And a zither is plucked. It's got strings.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Let's hear a little bit. This is Mother's last word to her son.
I never can forget the day when my dear mother did sweetly say, you are leaving, my darling boy. You always have been your mother's joy.
So, Lance, what is it about that instrument? Why is there so much instrument over what it was he was playing?
Well, I think in the 78 RPM record community, Washington Phillips has kind of, for years, has been a giant of mystery, where, you know, these collectors have talked about the instrument, because on the labels that came out in the 20s, it just says novelty instrument. There's no exact term of what it was. And I think when we were putting together our first set, it was a gospel box set called Goodbye Babylon. We encountered Washington Phillips through this collector community. And Michael was writing at that time for the Austin Statesman newspaper, and he put out an article in 2002 sort of answering some of these questions and asking more questions. And to a small amount of people, that article really caused some waves, and people started to understand Washington Phillips differently. We started to see him as, you know, there was this myth. Another myth besides the instrument was that he had gone into a mental asylum and died as in an insane asylum. And Michael was able to debunk that myth. And so, you know, I think Washington Phillips is someone that we didn't know a lot about other than the records. And here we are 80 years later, 90 years later, figuring out what he was playing and what his life was like.
So he was a recording artist with Columbia between 1927 and 1929, which is a big deal. That's a pretty big deal. So Doris, did he brag about his recording career?
No, he was not a person to brag. All he did was played his music, sold his syrup, ribbon cane syrup, and his various liniments and ointments that he produced from herbs out there in the country. And we never knew anything about Columbia or his recording or anything as a community. The first time I knew about that was when Michael called me and introduced me to it. This community knew nothing about Columbia.
But he was also a jackleg Baptist preacher, right, Doris?
That's right.
Meaning, jackleg meaning that he didn't have a church of his own.
Didn't have a church of his own, and he was not credentialed, and he was just not recognized by any of the key denominations. But when he would go around to the churches, sometimes they would let him preach. But he was like a vagabond. He was just not accepted into the in circles of the community, even a small community like Simsboro. We loved him. We would take care of him when he would get sick. My mother would. But he was just different. He was unique. He was artistic. But at that time, we didn't know about we had no appreciation for his artistic ability. We just heard the songs. We accepted them, especially in church, because my main song was Take Your Burden to the Lord and Leave Them There. That inspired me all my life.
Take your burden to the Lord and leave it there.
So let's hear another track, and this is one of his more well-known songs, actually. It's called Denomination Blues.
Mm-hmm.
I want to tell you the natural fact. Every man don't understand the Bible like, but that's all now. But you better have Jesus. I tell you that's all.
So, Michael, in a way, his status as a kind of a vagabond, as Doris says, made it a lot harder for you to get information on him. And Lance was mentioning that for a long time people thought he died in this asylum. That was a case of mistaken identity. What happened there?
Well, when I first started doing research, I was researching the Washington Phillips who died in 1938 in Austin. Like Lance said, I was a music critic for the Austin American Statesman, and I had heard a record by Washington Phillips, and that's where the mystery started with me. The music, I just thought, I've never heard anything like this before or since. And I think that his introspective style of songwriting was totally unique for the time. And so I was looking for an excuse to write about him, and, you know, the paper's not going to pay you to write about a guy from East Texas. And once I found the Austin angle, that's what I researched. And for about a week, I thought I did a lot of research on the guy who died, and then I found out later on that it was his cousin. Actually, it wasn't. It was a different Washington Phillips. They had the same grandfather, but these were the townspeople of Teague and Simsboro who they kept telling me, no, it was my cousin, the other cousin that played the music, not the one who died in Austin. And so, it took me about a week, and when I finally figured out, I called this guy named Virgil Keaton, who was related to both of the Washington Phillips. And he was also related to, I think, Washington Phillips' mother, Nancy, was his aunt also. There was another relation that way. And he's the one that set me straight. And when I got off the phone, that's the time I realized that they had the wrong guy all along, and I had the right guy. And from that time on, it's really been kind of my mission to follow through on every bit of information I find about Washington Phillips. Because, you know, I'm not really a great researcher. The thing is, I was the first one to really look into it. The people who had written all the stuff about Washington Phillips before were Europeans who were basing that on death certificates that they got through the mail. I was able to get in my car and drive for 3 hours and talk to eyewitnesses. And one of the reasons why it did work is because so many of the people who knew Washington Phillips and lived next to him, like Durden Dixon and Doris and Loisy Mims and other people, they're still alive, you know. And when I first started doing the research in 2002, there was a lot more people alive than now. So I was lucky that way. I was able to talk to, you know, eyewitnesses, and they set me straight.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with music journalist Michael Corcoran, Teague, Texas resident Doris Neely, and Dusted Digital co-founder Lance Ledbetter of Atlanta. Lance, that brings me to you. You talked about how you first heard Washington Phillips in 2003 when you were putting together Goodbye Babylon, but what was it you heard? What are you hearing in Washington Phillips that makes him so unique?
It's one of those things, you know, I think people that hear Washington Phillips, it either strikes a chord inside them or it does not. And the people that does strike a chord inside, it strikes it very hard. It's a music that's very powerful, very haunting music that, for me personally, I've never been able to forget. And I know a lot of other people that feel the same way. I mean, it's been pretty interesting with this release, the Washington Phillips and his Mangerine Dreams, to see it sort of connect and into a mainstream audience. Like, it was covered by CNN and The New Yorker, and people heard his music, and it struck that chord inside them, too. And I just think it's very unique. Michael, through his research, was able to try to come up with some theories on how this instrument was built, why he built it this way. But we don't know. There's still a lot of questions about where he got these ideas to make this instrument, where he developed this style of musical playing. And I think people, when they hear it, they like to try to figure it out, too, because it's very special. There's no one else like it.
That sounds angelic. Let's hear another song. This is I've Got the Key to the Kingdom.
I got the key to the kingdom, and the devil can't do me no harm. I got the key to the kingdom, and the devil can't do me no harm. Well, you take old prophet Daniel, they put him in the lion's den.
So, Doris, did he sound like that even when he was older? Did he preserve his voice?
Yes, he did. He was about 74 when he died, which in today's society, that's not very old, you know. So he preserved everything that you're hearing. It brings back memories to me because it's so real. That's how he was. That's how he sounded.
You can still remember him singing from
wagon? Yes. In fact, I get a little teary as I reread the book this morning I became a little teary just reflecting on him.
Michael, how do we know it was called a Manzarine?
Well, there was an article that came out in the Teague Chronicle in 1907, which was actually 20 years before Washington Phillips recorded. He was only 47 years old when he first, stepped into a studio. And in this article in the Teague Chronicle, it describes the instrument, and it describes how he plucked it, and it was, two by four, 3 feet and that sort of thing. And it said it was an instrument he made himself that he called a Manzarine. And so I just thought that was a really good thing to delve into. Why did he call it a Manzarine? And I have some theories about that I explore. As Lance said, there are, even though I did uncover a lot of things that nobody knew about, there's a lot of things that are still left out there that we don't know.
Doris, have people in the neighborhood who still remember Washington Phillips, have you guys all read the book and listened to the recordings?
I couldn't say. I don't know. Most of them were at the book signing, but no one has mentioned it since. There's not been a gathering in the community where we discussed it. It's just as if it was just a dream. It came and it went just like Mr. Washington Phillips did.
So, Lance, this is what your company does, finding these sort of oftentimes obscure or forgotten things. It's incredibly labor-intensive. I have to imagine the repair job on these recordings was incredible. Why? Why do this?
Well, I think the way this set came together was in 2013, I reached out to Michael and just asked him, I said, is there anything that you think that's not out there about Washington Phillips? Because to me, he's one of the greatest musicians America's ever produced. And if there's a chance that we can know more about this person and who he was and what his life was like, to me, that's it's just something that needs to happen.
Yeah, but why that? Why is it something that needs to happen?
I think it needs to happen because these people are too important to we're too close to it. Like, he died in 1954. I reached out to Michael in 2013. That's not that long in the grand scheme of things, between that in that time
yeah,
period.
Yeah, you guys deal with much older recordings.
We deal with much older, but we have the opportunity that we're never going to have the opportunities to meet special people like Doris, who have these memories that they're carrying with them. And when Michael is able to uncover or interview Doris and people in the T community to uncover more information about Washington Phillips, there's not a second chance at that, and when people 100 years from now are still celebrating Washington Phillips' music, we'll have put together more of a foundation on who he was so that they can know more about what made this great music.
That's Lance Ledbetter, co-founder of Atlanta record label Dust to Digital. You also heard Michael Corcoran, a Texas-based music journalist, both nominated for a Grammy Award for their new republished collection of songs, pictures, and stories called Washington Phillips and His Manzarine Dreams. And we also spoke with Doris Neely, a personal friend of Washington Phillips. Thanks so much to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
That's our show for today, but we want to hear from you. Who is a lesser-known musician that you think doesn't get his or her due? Who deserves more recognition in your mind? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Twitter. We're at OST Talk or find us on Facebook. For today, that's on Second Thought. From GPB News, I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.